This podcast is brought to you by Knowledge at Wharton. For more information, please visit knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu.
We're here today with Wharton Management professors Tyler Rye and Adam Cobb to talk a little bit about their latest research, which was done in conjunction with Indiana University's Eric Zhao. It focuses on funding for microfinance organizations. Tyler and Adam, thanks for being here.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having us.
So first of all, give us a short summary of this research. So you were looking at funding for microfinance organizations. Tell us where this came from and what questions you were trying to answer.
Sure. So Adam and I have been looking at microfinance in different capacities for a while now, and Eric has as well. And one of the things that is a little bit surprising about the space is that you're making loans to poor people, but the money that is actually used to finance those loans, it's not like a typical bank where they mobilize their deposits to then lend out the money. What happens in microfinance is you count on upstream funders, and the microfinance organizations themselves are more of a flow-through. And so no one had really looked at how this upstream funding works. And we managed to get access to really great data through the Microfinance Information Exchange, and it gave us a chance to look at how the upstream funding works as a way to analyze downstream impacts. Now, in the literature, it suggests that microfinance in a nation works best when you have a really robust ecology of different kinds of microfinance lenders. So you want to have big, established, more commercial, profitable organizations, but you also want to have smaller, less profitable organizations that aren't quite financially sustainable yet, maybe doing a little bit more outreach, and you need that funding go to all of these organizations to ensure you're getting sustainable outreach, good competition, and a healthy sector overall. And so what we were looking at was how funding flows to these different types of microfinance organizations and who the different funders are. So it turns out about $30 billion a year that we can track flows into microfinance around the world each year. And it comes primarily from two sources. One is commercial lenders, mostly in Western Europe and the United States, and they have commercial goals. They want to get their money back. They may want a little bit of a social return on investment as well. But really, this is risk capital. They're going to lend this money out, but they want to see it returned. On the other hand, you have development banks and multilateral aid agencies, and they're more interested in funding development in the sector. And so when things are working well, you have the commercial lenders funding the big established commercial microfinance organizations, and you have the public organizations funding the smaller, not yet sustainable ones. And so no one had analyzed this. So our top line analysis was just to see if this actually held up in practice, because some people suggest it doesn't. And what we found is, in fact, it does. You know, in a steady state, you see this ecology work the way it should. It all kind of lines up nicely. But when you start to look at uncertainty in a country, political uncertainty, financial uncertainty, when things get volatile and it's a little less clear, you know, how previous strategies, investment strategies are going to work, you see all of the funders retreat to a safe harbor in the largest microfinance organizations. And this is public and commercial funders. And this is tied to a lot of very adverse outcomes in the microfinance sectors of this country. And this is really, you know, what it was that was the gist of the paper and the big thing that we uncovered.
So you started out with a number of different hypotheses about microfinance and organizations and how they're funded. And some of them held up and some of them, there was a little bit of a surprise. So tell us a little bit about some of the key takeaways from this paper.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that was at least a takeaway for me is it wasn't so clear to me exactly whether or not this would map on the way we expected. In particular, as Tyler alluded to, there is a little bit of work, mostly anecdotal evidence that suggests that there's a lot of competition between these more public funders and these commercial funders, and that they actually are both targeting these really large, sustainable, profitable organizations. So I wasn't sure whether or not things would play out, because the evidence, if you look at the microfinance literature right now, it suggests that they're really kind of targeting the same types of microfinance lenders. And so just uncovering that, well, at least in a steady steady state, that doesn't seem to be the case, was, I think, a nice thing to discover. They're actually doing what they profess to do and probably what they should be doing. But at the same time, the fact that even things that are a little bit further away or kind of higher level, like political uncertainty or financial uncertainty, is actually affecting these decisions that are being made by these commercial and public funders, you know, half a world away, that they're actually really paying attention to these things and they're making conscious strategies that wasn't exactly what maybe a lot of people would expect. And in fact, we got a chance to talk to some of these people, and they were like, yeah, this is totally what we do. It doesn't make a lot of sense to invest in these smaller, less sustainable microfinance lenders if everything's going to go, you know, if the economy is really going, turning poorly, and these entities might disappear anyway. We should. It actually fulfills our social mission. And so another surprising thing is they actually still feel like they're holding to this social mission, even though they're changing their lending strategy, which is, at least in our field, is something that we wouldn't expect. That actually that's seen as sort of kind of more of a change in your ideology or a change in your strategy. And they don't see that that a change in investment behavior is tied to a change in strategy. They actually see those two things being compatible.
But this change in investment behavior, it does have implications for people who might receive loans from them, to the organization itself. And so in terms of this paper, what are some of the practical implications? If I'm a microfinance organization, especially if I'm a smaller one or one that's in an uncertain climate, how can I take this paper and apply it? What can I do?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'll answer it in two parts. There's the implications for the organizations, and there's the what they can do and what they should do. So in terms of the implications, I mean, building on what Adam was saying, one of the really striking things about our finding is that under these conditions of uncertainty, if you are a small microfinance organization, even one that's managed well and turning a reasonable return on your investment, there's a good chance that if things become uncertain, you're going to lose this funding, and it's going to put you in a really precarious position. Now, at the same time, these forms of political and economic uncertainty are also things that are likely to put people who are on the edge of poverty into poverty. And so what this means is that as this is happening, as people are more likely to be, you know, desperate and very poor, the organizations that are the ones that are most targeted to addressing their needs are the ones that are going to have their funding dry up first. So this is it's a big issue, and there's no easy answer to what should happen here. So in the paper, we talk about a couple of different things. So one is on the policy side. Governments should probably make provisions to step in, have emergency capital reserve funds, something to restore the funding to the organizations that are having it dry up when things become uncertain. This is going to be the way that you ensure the money keeps on flowing to the people who need it, as well as ensuring that you're going to have the basis for a healthy microfinance sector once things calm down again. Beyond that, seen as size seems to be the big driver of investment decisions under uncertainty. We speculate that maybe the smaller, not yet sustainable microfinance organizations could band together. They could work together. They could merge, do other things to get some of the advantages of size in order to, you know, compete for these loans that are progressively moving up market.
Oh, and another thing we found, it's not as emphasized quite as strongly in the paper, is that microfinance, these lenders, if they have sort of better and more transparent financial reporting, actually seems to help a little bit too. And that is something that's relatively low cost for them to employ. And it does suggest that really a lot of this is about risk. So from these funders, it's really about risk. So anything that these microfinance lenders can do that make them appear to be less risky, including more transparency, including growing or size, or anything governments can do that can guarantee loans or do other things, is really going to help ensure that the microfinance lending structure kind of holds in place during these times of uncertainty.
So, could you talk to me a little bit about some misperceptions that are dispelled by this research?
I think one misperception that is dispelled by this research is this notion that public and commercial funders are crowding each other out. More specifically, there is this big concern in the microfinance literature that these public funders don't need the same kind of rate of return on capital. And so they're offering loans to really big, stable, good performing lenders in these countries and able to offer better rates, lower interest rates, and so these better loan terms. And so it's actually not enabling the infrastructure, sort of this ecosystem to grow. And so there's this kind of this big push to get these public funders to go and invest in the smaller, less sustainable. And at least at the baseline, our results do not indicate that this is as big of a problem as some of the anecdotal evidence suggests. So I think that's definitely one thing.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. The finding that Adam's talking about caused quite a bit of turmoil in the microfinance community, with the idea that the public funders weren't being faithful to their mission. You know, they'd espouse lofty goals of fostering development in the sector. And if, in fact, they were just investing in the largest, safest organizations, trying to make their organizations look good, make their investment team look good, I mean, this would have been a big problem. And it certainly is out there in some instances in microfinance in different countries. But I think, you know, one of the things that is valuable about our finding is to put some boundary conditions around this. And part of what let us do this was access to more complete data. So the findings that were out there that were showing this crowding out effect were based on a limited sample of lenders and a limited sample of countries. So it was really just looking in Latin American countries. Now, with this broader data, looking at the capital flows around the world, we really get a much fuller sweep of what's going on. And in doing that, we can see that there are contexts where crowding out takes place and there should be action taken to address that. But it really seems to be linked to political and financial uncertainty in a country, whereas under steady state, these organizations are acting in ways that are faithful to their mission. It's just that their mission changes a little bit under uncertainty, and there's a lot of good rational reasons for why they'd behave in that way.
And now, what would you say are some other things that kind of sets this research apart from other research being conducted about microfinance?
I mean, a lot of research on microfinance is really looking at the lendee and the borrower relationship and whether or not microfinance helps get people out of poverty, whether it leads to these good social outcomes. That's always been the promise of microfinance. And I think part of it's due to data limitations. People haven't really looked at this funder microfinance lendee relationship yet. And the fact that microfinance lenders don't operate like banks, so they don't mobilize their own deposits, and they are dependent on these other organizations for them to get the capital necessary to lend out, is something that I imagine if you talk to a person who just has a casual understanding of microfinance, might not even know that's how they get their money, or whether or not how that money flows in the terms actually has a big impact on more downstream on the lendee-borrower relationship. So I think that was a really... One of the big appeals to me to take part in this research is it just really hasn't been explored. There's only been maybe one or two studies, and as Tyler alluded to, they haven't had the best data, and it hasn't been that complete over enough years. And at least I think this is a good first step to start really looking at the importance of the funder-lendee relationship, as opposed to not to say that the borrower-lendee relationship, lender relationship isn't important, and obviously research needs to continue on that front as well. But we really need to be looking at the entire supply chain and not just one part of it.
And what's next for this research? Where are you guys going to go with this next?
Well, we've been talking about a bunch of different ideas. It's fun to think about where it might go. So one of the things that we've been talking about is looking at the effects that different forms of capital have on the behavior of the organizations. So in this research, we were looking at how the funders behave. And in follow-ons, we're thinking about taking that to the microfinance organization level and looking at how the composition of capital in a country affects the behavior of the organizations. Getting back to a question you asked earlier about, you know, what are the effects of this in terms of the organization's behavior on the ground, doing their work trying to lend to poor people. So we're starting to look at, how these organizations make lending decisions in terms of how they apply the screens when they're deciding what organizations to invest in, what sort of pressures this puts on the organization, both directly and indirectly, and how having different pots of capital available in a country might allow for different types of organizations to flourish, or you know, how it might, you know, just have the whole ecology, you know, implode on itself as well, kind of like what we see under uncertainty in the funding relationship. And, you know, to the extent that this speaks about issues of social finance, it potentially has implications for our understanding about how we affect positive outcomes, not just through corporate social responsibility and social action, but also how money comes into corporations more broadly. And so what we'd like to be able to show are some boundary conditions around when social investment has positive versus negative outcomes.
For more business news and analysis from Knowledge at Wharton, please visit knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu.